As Wisconsin's population ages with a higher than average number of baby boomers, many seniors, families, and communities are worried about the impact of dementia.
One community is trying to get ahead of the issue. An effort in Watertown is trying to boost community awareness of the needs of people with dementia and to help churches, businesses, and other organizations help create a more welcoming environment.
Jan Zimmerman joins us now. She's Director of Dementia Outreach and Education for the Lutheran Home Association, and she's President of the Watertown Dementia Awareness Coalition. Jan, thanks for joining us today.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Well, what led to this effort to make Watertown a more welcoming community for people with dementia?
Well, I work for the Lutheran Home Association of Belle Plaine, Minnesota, which is a national leader with dementia care services and awareness. And at one of the administrators' meeting, Lori LeBay was there from Alzheimer's Speaks, and I was just very impressed with her passion. And as we talked about what we were going to do for our annual aging and dementia workshop, I realized that we have addressed dementia with the community members, care partners, those living with dementia, healthcare, but we really hadn't looked at the community and businesses. So I did an internet search to see what was out there and what other communities were doing in the United States so that we could possibly go forward and look at making Watertown more dementia aware, dementia friendly. And I could not find anything. It was all reference to the United Kingdom, New Zealand, Australia, etc. And I really felt it was a shame that the United States wasn't a leader in this. So we decided that year we were going to focus our training on making the community more dementia-aware and dementia-friendly. And that's kind of what motivated us to get started on this.
Well, let's start with the awareness part of it. Dementia is something that people maybe don't want to talk about until or maybe even if it affects them or their family. So is step one just getting people talking about this?
That's the number one thing, is just start talking. We can't find a solution if nobody's willing to talk about it. One of the biggest hurdles that we've had is finding those diagnosed with dementia who are willing to talk with us and let their voice be heard. Even family members don't want to talk about it. And so we are working towards making it less frightening to talk about it. There's a big stigma still associated with dementia. It used to be cancer had that stigma, and nobody would talk about the cancer. They wouldn't even say the word. It'd be the big C. But now people talk about it very openly, and it's getting the research attention that it needs. Well, dementia isn't there now. So we need to get people to start talking about it and not be afraid of it.
And not just talking about it, but talking to people with dementia. I understand people with dementia out in their community can feel very disconnected from their communities. So what are you looking at from people out and about to get them talking to people who have dementia, their neighbors, their fellow churchgoers, that sort of thing?
There is, as I said, very much the stigma. A number of people, and it just breaks my heart every time I hear it, they'll tell me that when they tell friends that they have dementia or maybe their spouse has dementia, there's this immediate, they said, it's almost a physical withdrawal that you'll see. They won't look at them in the eyes anymore. They talk about, oh, I'm so sorry, you're having to suffer with this. And their friends start to fade away and family members start to fade away as well. So what we're doing is providing education out in the community so that there's more of a public awareness. We are businesses who have received the education for it and are willing to look at ways that their environment can be a little more dementia-friendly. We'll earn the Purple Angel. And then that will be put into their window so that people walking by know that this is a business who understand that there may be some different needs with somebody with some cognitive or memory loss, and that they're willing to work with them, and they've had the training on how to work with them in a dignified, respectful manner.
And Jan, as I understand it, you're helping provide business owners tools to help train their staff, the people who are actually interacting with customers.
Correct, correct. We go into businesses and we do one-on-one training with them. We also have written materials and handouts that they can use to review the information, or if they have new staff, they can pass that on to them. We don't expect anybody to become dementia specialists, but we do want them to realize that there are actual physical changes that are going on. It is brain failure. It's not somebody just being stubborn or being non-compliant, as some people will say, but their brain is actually dying, and they can't help having problems with the memory, having problems with communication, etc.
We're talking to Jan Zimmerman with the Watertown Dementia Awareness Coalition, looking at efforts to make Watertown a better place to live for people who have dementia.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you doing things like this in your community? Do you have questions about how this might work? And if you deal with dementia in your family or in your work, what challenges do you see and what solutions? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation with Jan Zimmerman from the Watertown Dementia Awareness Coalition about creating a dementia-friendly community.
And you can join us now at 800-642-1234. If you're dealing with dementia yourself or in your family, what are the obstacles in your community? What could your community do better to make it a better place to live? Also, if you have questions for our guest about how to do something like this in your community, you can also call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Jan, I promised I'd talk to you about how to have a conversation with people with dementia, because you mentioned that people cut themselves off. Maybe it's just because of not knowing how to have that conversation. Do you have some advice?
Yeah, there are some real communication concerns when a person has a diagnosis of dementia. They a lot of times have problems following conversation. They'll lose a train of thought. They may have problems finding words. They may use the familiar words repetitively. They may invent new words in order to describe objects. And they may have problems developing an organization to their words. It doesn't make a lot of sense to them. So the way we respond to this is being understanding and encouraging them to take their time. The words you don't want in your vocabulary when talking to somebody with dementia is, do you remember? Don't you remember? Because that's the issue, is they do not remember. And it easily frustrates them, and trying to get them to remember just does not work. Also learning the words, I'm sorry, and you're right. just because so often somebody once said, it's not the problem that they're confused. It's the problem that I'm confused trying to understand what they're saying. And so often that's what it is.
And one suggestion I've heard, and it goes along with you saying, you know, don't go, don't you remember, is that use what's there. Work with what's there now. Don't try to recapture what's been lost.
That's it. They live in the here and now, and when you're with somebody with dementia, you need to live in their here and now. They may be in a past time, which to you and I are thinking, okay, that's history. But for them, they are literally in that time, and they may be 20 years old. And so it may be that a husband will come up to his wife and try to kiss her, and she'll just get all freaked out because who is this old man trying to kiss her? Well, I'm your husband. Well, no, you're not. She's 20. Therefore, her husband must be 20. And so they are literally in that time. So you need to be with them in that time.
I've seen efforts elsewhere, including in Milwaukee, to promote a creative expression for people with Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia. Is that part of what you're working on in Watertown?
It is. Part of the brain that kind of hangs on is the creative side of the brain. And so they respond to music and art, literature, longer than they do with some of their other senses. And so there are Memories in the Making, which is an art program, and Heritage Homes is quite active in this area with doing that, where they are expressing themselves through art. And while the pictures are nice, what is really captivating are the stories that all of a sudden they can tell that maybe they haven't been able to communicate and share before. There are music programs that are out there that music will touch part of the people's soul for a long time. And so they have developed personal playlists for music that meant something to them. And it might be music from the 30s, 40s, and 50s because that is what they remember because it's in the longer memory part of their brain.
So you're working on a lot of fronts here, businesses, arts and culture, community members getting involved. Are you having people come to you from outside of Watertown saying, hey, we want to do some of this stuff. Could you be a model? Could you tell us what we can do?
Oh, yeah. We had no idea that when we did this, it was going to get the attention that it did and that, you know, it had spread as much as it did. West Bend, Middleton, Morrison, Jackson, Jefferson County, Dodge County, they've all been in conversation with me on what things that they could do. Jefferson and Dodge County have dementia specialists, and quite often we will collaborate and talk about what they are doing and what we're doing and how we can assist each other. I've gotten calls across the nation, Pennsylvania, Minnesota, Florida, Illinois, Washington. They all want to know what they can do to start something in their communities. And a lot of them are either small businesses who say, hey, this is really important, or they're single individuals who are saying, this is something that has to get started. And so it's these grassroots movements that are really moving this forward.
And Jan, as we wrap up, I know you're in contact with people who have dementia in the Watertown area. Are you at a point where you think this is starting to make an improvement in their lives, let them participate as fully as they can?
It is starting. Not as much as I would like to see, but it is starting. We had one person who had questions, and they were walking down the street and saw a purple angel in a window. And so they stopped in and said, you know, hey, I saw your purple angel. I have some questions. Where can I go to for answers? So they're starting to associate the purple angel with a business that's dementia aware, dementia friendly, and that could be a possible resource or direct them to a resource that they need.
Jan, thank you so much for joining us to tell us about this effort.
You're more than welcome.
We've been talking to Jan Zimmerman. She's Director of Dementia Outreach and Education for the Lutheran Home Association. She's president of the Watertown Dementia Awareness Coalition. Many of us have seen the home movie footage that captured the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, also known as the Zapruder film. This footage proved to be invaluable to the assassination investigation. To this day, it's one of the most studied pieces of film ever taken.
Joining us now to talk about how amateur film can be used for historical research is Amy Sloper, film archivist at the Wisconsin Center for Film and Theater Research. Amy, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, that Zapruder film is maybe the most famous example of the sort of home shot footage, which is then used and mined and poured over later for historical facts and details. But can you talk about some of the other amateur films that have been important, maybe not at that level, but also significant?
Sure. All home movies are important in their own way, but there are some others. The Zapruder film is on the National Film Registry. There's other examples of home movies that are on the National Film Registry, which are, the film registry is about, it takes films and showcases them, films that are important for American cultural heritage. So the other one is called Topaz, and that's a film from 1945 that was shot by a man who was interned in a Japanese-American internment camp in Utah. So it showed what life was like inside the camp. So that one's really important as well.
Right. That one sounds fascinating, especially since there weren't supposed to be video cameras inside the internment camp. So looking at Topaz, that film that was taken from that location during this specific time in U.S. history, what do we learn from it?
Well, it's, you know, it's an insight into what life was like for the people inside that camp. And a lot of people say the people look really happy inside in that movie, but people act a certain way in front of a camera, and that's important to remember. I don't think life was that happy inside of an internment camp. So the camera adds a level of interest for people. But yeah, it's just like the document of what it was actually like.
And didn't I read that the guy who shot that film from the internment camp, as someone who was living there, he said, "You didn't. I stayed away. I didn't want my camera to get taken away. So you didn't see the guards and you didn't see the fences and the barbed wire."
Right, exactly. And he wasn't supposed to have that camera in there. But I think he worked. He worked in the place where stuff was coming in and out of the camp, essentially. So he had access to getting that material.
So how do we know if what we're shooting is going to have any value for posterity, for history? Should we just do it for ourselves and our families, or should we be shooting with an eye to history?
I think we should all just shoot with an eye to our families, but keep in mind that what we shoot is important to other people. So, of course, our home movies are important for our immediate families, for our future ancestors. But also the things you're capturing are documenting culture as it's happening. So home culture, especially the way we celebrate birthdays, the way we celebrate holidays, and also the things in the background end up being really important. So the way that the cars looked, the fashion that people wore, what the inside of people's houses looked like, all ends up being really important information for historians.
Well, we live in an era when filmmaking has been democratized to a large extent. You don't need expensive cameras. You don't need expensive film. Lots of times a phone will do it. It's as simple as that. There are some other ways, of course, too. But does this mean we're going to be seeing lots and lots of this stuff now that could hold clues? And people looking back will say that's important. So I'm glad we have all this.
Yeah, I think so. It's true, we're going to have a lot more footage like this. The nice thing about 8mm and Super 8 film is a roll was only 4 minutes long. So it could only last for 4 minutes. And when you find that stuff, you know, you find a roll of film in an archive, or you find them at antique shops a lot now, or flea markets, you know it's going to be 4 minutes. And in the future, people are going to, even VHS tapes last for 120 minutes. So we're only, you know, exponentially increasing the amount of footage we have. And as an archivist, that, of course, makes me nervous. It's just a lot of stuff to deal with. But it's still important.
Well, I mean, would you go so far as to say maybe we shouldn't go crazy with our home videos and shoot 120 minutes? Maybe we should just shoot 4 or 5 minutes of film.
Or at some point, it's important to think about what you think is the most important of the 6 hours that you shot, and maybe make sure you're saving the most important 20 minutes of footage, or the most important section of footage, and editing that out, or, you know, just making sure you're taking care of the file.
It's also easier than ever, it seems like, to edit the film that we have. You don't need to be an expert anymore to do this. Does that raise questions about the authenticity, the veracity of what we're seeing?
Yeah, I think especially when you're talking about going back to the Zapruder film, you know, things that are documenting crimes or footage that's documenting events that could be used as evidence. It is easy to re-edit things. You know, we've had good examples of edited video being used against people in the news lately. It's something to think about. But the best thing that I think anyone can do is to manage their own archives of material, is to just try to save the best parts, the things that you think are the most important. And don't just shoot something and forget about it and expect someone else to take care of it for you in the future, because the truth is that with digital files, if you don't manage it now, in 10 years, it might not even open on your computer. So it's best to be thinking about it now.
All right, we're going to get into some of that advice about how to do just that in just a bit as we talk with Amy Sloper, film archivist at the Wisconsin Center for Film and Theater Research. We're talking about how these amateur films that we're shooting today may have big historical impact and may be of great interest to someone down the road as they take a look at our life and our times. And so, Amy, you said we have to manage the film that we take now. So how do we go about doing that?
Sure. So depending on what format your footage is on, there are different recommendations. So if you have film, which would be Super 8 film, 8mm film, or 16mm film that maybe came from your family, there's certain things you can do. The film itself, you should always save the original. You should store it in storage conditions where you yourself would be comfortable. So moderate temperature, moderate humidity, not in an attic, not in a basement. If you decide to digitize those films, you should still always keep the original. And then if once you get to a file format, you should be migrating and opening that file at least every 5 years to make sure that the file format still works and that you still have some software that will open the file. If you have home movies on VHS tape or other videotape formats, you can also migrate those. You can digitize them, but still save the originals.
Okay, so you're using the word migrate a lot. Mm-hmm. Explain a little more about what you mean by that and how we migrate something.
So by that, I mean digitizing it into a file format. So there are ways you can do this yourself. Especially, it's easier with certain things. Usually with film, you need to send it to a professional lab to have them do it. But VHS tape, you can pretty easily and cheaply convert it to a digital file with your computer and like with spending less than $100 on a little converter. And there's information about how to do that on the Library of Congress's website, digitalpreservation.gov.
Okay.
They have nice guidelines for that. Your digital files that, well, when you're taking movies on your phone, they're already digital files, so you don't have to worry about migrating, but you do have to take them off your phone at some point and put them on your computer, put them in a safe spot, or, you know, on
what about something like a thumb drive? Is that too temporary?
It's a little temporary. Maybe you could have a few thumb drives with the same file on it. That would be a good idea. And make sure those are in a moderate environment, so not in a box buried in your basement where there might be a flood someday.
And, you know, most people who are taking these videos of their lives, their loved ones, they're probably not thinking about history. But if someone is a history buff and you know that you are at an event that might be historic, maybe a big demonstration, a social movement somehow, any advice about how to capture that moment on film?
I mean, you would want to, as you're recording it, be as steady as possible. So you get a clear picture. And then afterwards, make sure you take, if you're using your phone, take that file off of your phone and put it someplace safe. So on your computer and maybe another copy on a hard drive. And just make sure you open it regularly, like at minimum every 5 years, to make sure it still opens and the file format is still supported by your computer.
So open it regularly, take a look, and make sure everything's still in working order.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, great advice, Amy. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Amy Sloper, film archivist at the Wisconsin Center for Film and Theater Research.